Chapter 13, Eunomius separates from Eudoxius. A disturbance is raised at Alexandria by Eudoxius, and Athanasius flees into voluntary exile again, but in consequence of the clamors of the people the emperor recalls and re-establishes him in his see. About the same time Eunomius I separated himself from Eudoxius, and held assemblies apart, because after he had repeatedly entreated that his preceptor Aetius might be received into communion, Eudoxius continued to oppose it. Now Eudoxius did this against his preference, for he did not reject the opinion with Aetius since it was the same as his own, too, but he yielded to the prevailing sentiment of his own party, who objected to Aetius as heterodox. This was the cause of the division between Eunomius and Eudoxius, and such was the state of things at Constantinople. But the church at Alexandria was disturbed by an edict of the Praetorian prefects, sent hither by means of Eudoxius. Whereupon Athanasius, dreading the irrational impetuosity of the multitude, and fearing lest he should be regarded as the author of the excesses that might be committed, concealed himself for 4 entire months in an ancestral tomb. Inasmuch, however, as the people, on account of their affection for him, became seditious in impatience of his absence, the emperor, on ascertaining that on this account agitation prevailed at Alexandria, ordered by his letters that Athanasius should be suffered to preside over the churches without molestation. And this was the reason why the Alexandrian church enjoyed tranquility until the death of Athanasius. How the Arian faction became possessed of the churches after his decease, we shall unfold in the course of our history. 3. Chapter 14, The Arians ordained Demophilus after the death of Eudoxius at Constantinople, but the Orthodox party constitute Evagrius his successor. The emperor Valens, leaving Constantinople again, set out towards Antioch, but on his arrival at Nicomedia, a city of Bithynia, his progress was arrested by the following circumstances. Eudoxius, the bishop of the Arian Church, who has been in possession of the seat of the Constantinopolitan Church for 91 years, died soon after the emperor's departure from that city, in the third consulate too of Valentinian and Valens. The Arians therefore appointed Demophilus to succeed him, but the Homusians, considering that an opportunity was afforded them, elected a certain Evagrius, a person who maintained their own principles, and Astartheus, who had been bishop of Antioch, formally ordained him. He had been recalled from exile by Jovian, and had at this time privately come to Constantinople, for the purpose of confirming the adherence to the doctrine of the Homusian. Chapter 15, The emperor banishes Evagrius and Astartheus. The Arians persecute the Orthodox. When this had been accomplished, the Arians renewed their persecution of the Homusians, and the emperor was very soon informed of what had taken place, and apprehending the subversion of the city in consequence of some popular tumult, immediately sent troops from Nicomedia to Constantinople, ordering that both he who had been ordained, and the one who had ordained him, should be apprehended and sent into exile in different regions. Astartheus therefore was banished to Bzira, city of Thrace, and Evagrius was conveyed to another place. After this the Arians, becoming bolder, grievously harassed the Orthodox party, frequently beating them, reviling them, causing them to be imprisoned and fined. In short, they practiced distressing and intolerable annoyances against them. The sufferers were induced to appeal to the emperor for protection against their adversaries if haply they might obtain some relief from this oppression. But whatever hope of redress they might have cherished from this quarter was altogether frustrated, inasmuch as they thus merely spread their grievances before him who was the very author of them. Chapter 16, Certain presbyters burnt in a ship by order of Valens. Famine in Phrygia. Certain pious men of the clerical order, 80 in number, among whom Urbanus, Theodore, and Mundimus were the leaders, proceeded to Nicomedia, and there presented to the emperor a supplicatory petition, informing him and complaining of the ill usage to which they had been subjected. The emperor was filled with wrath, but dissembled his displeasure in their presence, and gave Modestus the prefect a secret order to apprehend these persons, and put them to death. The manner in which they were destroyed, being unusual, deserves to be recorded. The prefect, fearing that he should excite the populace to a seditious movement against himself if he attempted the public execution of so many, pretended to send the men away into exile. Accordingly, as they received the intelligence of their destiny with great firmness of mind, the prefect ordered that they should be embarked as if to be conveyed to their several places of banishment, having meanwhile enjoined on the sailors to set the vessel on fire, as soon as they reached the mid-sea, that their victims being so destroyed, might even be deprived of burial. This injunction was obeyed, for when they arrived at the middle of the Eustatian Gulf, the crew set fire to the ship, and then took refuge in a small bark which followed them, and so escaped. Meanwhile it came to pass that a strong easterly wind blew, and the burning ship was roughly driven but moved faster and was preserved until it reached a port named Dacidysus, where it was utterly consumed together with the men who were shut up in it. Many have asserted that this impious deed was not suffered to go unpunished, for there immediately after arose so great a famine throughout all Phrygia, that a large proportion of the inhabitants were obliged to abandon their country for a time, and betake themselves some to Constantinople and some to other provinces. For Constantinople, notwithstanding the vast population it supplies, yet always abounds with the necessaries of life, all manner of provisions being imported into it by sea from various regions, and the Euxine which lies near it, furnishes it with wheat to any extent it may require. 1. Chapter 17, The Emperor Valens, while at Antioch, again persecutes the adherents of the Homusian. The Emperor Valens, little affected by the calamities resulting from the famine, went to Antioch in Syria, and during his residence there cruelly persecuted such as would not embrace Arianism. For not content with ejecting out of almost all the churches of the East those who maintained the Homusian opinion, he inflicted on them various punishments besides. He destroyed a greater number even than before, delivering them up to many different kinds of death, but especially drowning in the river. Chapter 18, Events at Edessa, Constancy of the Devout Citizens, and Courage of a Pious Woman. But we must here mention certain circumstances that occurred at Edessa in Mesopotamia. There is in that city a magnificent church, one dedicated to Saint Thomas the Apostle, wherein, on account of the sanctity of the place, religious assemblies are incessantly held. The Emperor Valens, wishing to inspect this edifice, and having learned that all who usually congregated there were opposed to the heresy which he favored, he is said to have struck the prefect with his own hand, because he had neglected to expel them thence also. As the prefect, after submitting to this ignominy, was most unwillingly constrained to subserve the emperor's indignation against them, for he did not desire to effect the slaughter of so great a number of persons, he privately suggested that no one should be found there. But no one gave heed either to his admonitions or to his menaces, for on the following day they all crowded to the church, too, and when the prefect was going towards it with a large military force in order to satisfy the emperor's rage, a poor woman leading her own little child by the hand hurried hastily by, on her way to the church, breaking through the ranks of the prefect's company of soldiers. The prefect, irritated at this, ordered her to be brought to him, and thus addressed her, "Wretched woman, whither are you running in so disorderly a manner?" She replied, "To the same place that others are hastening." "Have you not heard," said he, "that the prefect is about to put to death all that shall be found there?" "Yes," said the woman, "and therefore I hasten that I may be found there." "And whither are you dragging that little child?" said the prefect. The woman answered, "That he also may be made worthy of martyrdom." 3. The prefect, on hearing these things, conjecturing that a similar resolution actuated the others who were assembled there, immediately went back to the emperor, and informed him that all were ready to die in behalf of their own faith. He added that it would be preposterous to destroy so many persons at one time, and thus persuaded the emperor to control his wrath. In this way were the Edessans preserved from being massacred by order of their sovereign. Chapter 19, Slaughter of many persons by Valens, an account of their names, in consequence of a heathen prediction. 1. The cruel disposition of the emperor was at this time abused by an execrable demon, who induced certain curious persons to institute an inquiry by means of necromancy as to who should succeed Valens on the throne. To their magical incantations the demon gave responses not distinct and unequivocal, but as the general practice is, full of ambiguity, for displaying the four letters T-H, E, O, and D he declared that the name of the successor of Valens began with these, and that it was a compound name. When the emperor was apprised of this oracle, instead of committing to God, who alone can penetrate futurity, the decision of this matter, in contravention of those Christian principles to which he pretended the most zealous adherence, he put to death very many persons of whom he had the suspicion that they aimed at the sovereign power, thus such as were named Theodore, Theodotus, Theodosius, Theodulus, and the like, were sacrificed to the emperor's fears, and among the rest was Theodosiolus, a very brave man, descended from a noble family in Spain. Many persons therefore, to avoid the danger to which they were exposed, changed their names, giving up those which they had received from their parents in infancy as dangerous. This will be enough on that subject. Chapter 20, Death of Athanasius, and Elevation of Peter to his see. 1. It must be said that as long as Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, was alive, the emperor, restrained by the providence of God, abstained from molesting Alexandria and Egypt. Indeed, he knew very well that the multitude of those who were attached to Athanasius was very great, and on that account he was careful lest the public affairs should be hazarded by the Alexandrians, who are an irritable race, being excited to sedition. But Athanasius, after being engaged in so many and such severe conflicts on behalf of the church, departed this life in the second consulate too of Gratian and Probus, having governed that church amidst the greatest perils 46 years. He left as his successor Peter, a devout and eloquent man. Chapter 21. The Arians are allowed by the emperor to imprison Peter and to set Lucius over the See of Alexandria. Upon this the Arians, emboldened by their knowledge of the emperor's religious sentiments, again took courage, and without delay informed him of the circumstance. He was then residing at Antioch. Then indeed Uzoas, who presided over the Arians of that city, eagerly embracing the favorable opportunity thus presented, begged permission to go to Alexandria, for the purpose of putting Lucius the Arian in possession of the churches there. The emperor acceded to this request, and as speedily as possible Uzoas proceeded forthwith to Alexandria, attended by the imperial troops. Magnus, also, the emperor's treasurer, went with him. Moreover, an imperial mandate had been issued to Palladius, the governor of Egypt, enjoining him to aid them with a military force. Wherefore, having apprehended Peter, they cast him into prison, and after dispersing the rest of the clergy, they placed Lucius in the episcopal chair. Chapter 22. Silence of Sabinus on the misdeeds of the Arians, flight of Peter to Rome, massacre of the solitaries at the instigation of the Arians, of the outrages perpetrated upon the installation of Lucius, and the treatment of those who were ejected, both in the courts and outside of the courts, and how some were subjected to a variety of tortures, and others sent into exile even after this excruciating process, Sabinus takes not the slightest notice. In fact, being half disposed to Arianism himself, he purposely veils the atrocities of his friends. Peter, however, has exposed them in the letters he addressed to all the churches when he had escaped from prison. For this bishop, having managed to escape from prison, fled to Damasus, bishop of Rome. The Arians, though not very numerous, becoming thus possessed of the Alexandrian churches, soon after obtained an imperial edict directing the governor of Egypt to expel not only from Alexandria but even out of the country the favorers of the Homoousian doctrine, and all such as were obnoxious to Lucius. After this they assailed and disturbed and terribly harassed the monastic institutions in the desert. Armed men rushed in the most ferocious manner upon those who were utterly defenseless, and who would not lift an arm to repel their violence, so that numbers of unresisting victims were in this manner slaughtered with a degree of wanton cruelty beyond description. Chapter 23. The deeds of same holy persons who devoted themselves to a solitary life. 1. Since I have referred to the monasteries of Egypt, it may be proper here to give a brief account of them. They were founded probably at a very early period, but were greatly enlarged and augmented by a devout man whose name was Ammon. In his youth this person had an aversion to matrimony, but when some of his relatives urged him not to contemn marriage, but to take a wife to himself, he was prevailed upon and was married. On leading the bride with the customary ceremonies from the banquet room to the nuptial couch, after their mutual friends had withdrawn, he took a book too containing the epistles of the apostles and read to his wife Paul's epistle to the Corinthians, explaining to her the apostles' admonitions to married persons. 3. Adducing many external considerations besides, he descanted on the inconveniences and discomforts attending matrimonial intercourse, the pangs of childbearing, and the trouble and anxiety connected with rearing a family. He contrasted with all this the advantages of chastity, described the liberty and immaculate purity of a life of continence, and affirmed that virginity places persons in the nearest relation to the deity. By these and other arguments of a similar kind, he persuaded his virgin bride to renounce with him a secular life, prior to their having any conjugal knowledge of each other. Having taken this resolution, they retired together to the mountain of Nitria, and in a hut there inhabited for a short time one common ascetic apartment, without regarding their difference of sex, being according to the apostles, one in Christ. 4. But not long after, the recent and unpolluted bride thus addressed Ammon, "It is unsuitable," said she, "for you who practice chastity, to look upon a woman in so confined a dwelling. Let us therefore, if it is agreeable to you, perform our exercise apart." This agreement again was satisfactory to both, and so they separated, and spent the rest of their lives in abstinence from wine and oil, eating dry bread alone, sometimes passing over one day, at others fasting too, and sometimes more. Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, asserts in his Life of Antony, 5, that the subject of his memoir, who was contemporary with this Ammon, saw his soul taken up by angels after his decease. Accordingly, a great number of persons emulated Ammon's manner of life, so that by degrees the mountains of Nitria and Cytus were filled with monks, an account of whose lives would require an express work. As, however, there were among them persons of eminent piety, distinguished for their strict discipline and apostolic lives, who said and did many things worthy of being recorded, I deem it useful to interweave with my history a few particulars selected out of the great number for the information of my readers. It is said that Ammon never saw himself naked, being accustomed to say that it became not a monk to see even his own person exposed. And when once he wanted to pass a river, but was unwilling to undress, he besought God to enable him to cross without his being obliged to break his resolution, and immediately an angel transported him to the other side of the river. Another monk named Didymus VI lived entirely alone to the day of his death, although he had reached the age of 90 years. Arsenius, another of them, would not separate young delinquents from communion, but only those that were advanced in age, for, said he, when a young person is excommunicated he becomes hardened, but an elderly one is soon sensible of the misery of excommunication. Pior was accustomed to take his food as he walked along. As a certain one asked him, "Why do you eat thus?" "That I may not seem," said he, "to make eating serious business, but rather a thing done by the way." To another putting the same question he replied, "Lest even in eating my mind should be sensible of corporeal enjoyment." Isidore affirmed that he had not been conscious of sin even in thought for 40 years, and that he had never consented either to lust or anger. Pambos, being an illiterate man, went to someone for the purpose of being taught a psalm, and having heard the first verse of the 38th psalm, "I said I will take heed to my ways, that I offend not with my tongue." 7. He departed without staying to hear the second verse, saying, "This one will suffice, if I can practically acquire it." And when the person who had given him the verse reproved him because he had not seen him for the space of 6 months, he answered that he had not yet learnt to practice the verse of the psalm. After a considerable lapse of time, Being asked by one of his friends whether he had made himself master of the verse, his answer was, "I have scarcely succeeded in accomplishing it during 19 years." A certain individual, having placed gold in his hands for distribution to the poor, requested him to reckon what he had given him. "There is no need of counting," said he, "but of integrity of mind." This same Pambos, at the desire of Athanasius the bishop, came out of the desert to Alexandria, and on beholding an actress there, he wept. When those present asked him why he wept, he replied, "Two causes have affected me. One is the destruction of this woman, the other is that I exert myself less to please my God than she does to please obscene characters." Another said that a monk who did not work ought to be regarded as on a level with the covetous man. Phaedrus was well informed in many branches of natural philosophy, and was accustomed frequently to enter into expositions of the principles sometimes of one and sometimes of another department of science. But he always commenced his expositions with prayer. There were also among the monks of that period, two of the same name, of great sanctity, each being called Macarius, one of whom was from Upper Egypt, the other from the city of Alexandria. Both were celebrated for their ascetic discipline, the purity of their life and conversation, and the miracles which were wrought by their hands. The Egyptian Macarius performed so many cures, and cast out so many devils, that it would require a distinct treatise to record all that the grace of God enabled him to do. His manner toward those who resorted to him was austere, yet at the same time calculated to inspire veneration. The Alexandrian Macarius, while in all respects resembling his Egyptian namesake, differed from him in this, that he was always cheerful to his visitors, and by the affability of his manners led many young men to asceticism. Evagrius VIII became a disciple of these men, acquired from them the philosophy of deeds, whereas he had previously known that which consisted in words only. He was ordained deacon at Constantinople by Gregory of Nazianzus, and afterwards went with him into Egypt, where he became acquainted with these eminent persons, and emulated their course of conduct. And miracles were done by his hands as numerous and important as those of his preceptors. Books were also composed by him of very valuable nature, one of which is entitled The Monk, or, On Active Virtue, another The Gnostic, 9, or, To Him Who Is Deemed Worthy of Knowledge. This book is divided into 50 chapters. A third is designated Antireticus, and contains selections from the Holy Scriptures against tempting spirits, distributed into 8 parts, according to the number of the arguments. He wrote moreover 600 prognostic problems, and also 2 compositions in verse, one addressed to the monks living in communities, and the other to the Virgin. Whoever shall read these productions will be convinced of their excellence. It will not be out of place here, I conceive, to subjoin to what has been before stated, a few things mentioned by him respecting the monks. These are his words. 10. It becomes us to inquire into the habits of the pious monks who have preceded us, in order that we may correct ourselves by their example, for undoubtedly very many excellent things have been said and done by them. One of them was accustomed to say, that a drier and not irregular diet combined with love, would quickly conduct a monk into the haven of tranquility. The same individual freed one of his brethren from being troubled by apparitions at night, by enjoining him to minister while fasting to the sick. And being asked why he prescribed this, "Such affections," said he, "are by nothing so effectually dissipated as by the exercise of compassion." A certain philosopher of those times, coming to Antony the Just, said to him, "How can you endure, father, being deprived of the comfort of books?" "My book, O philosopher," replied Antony, "is the nature of things that are made, and it is present whenever I wish to read the words of God." That chosen vessel, 11, the aged Egyptian Macarius, asked me, "Why the strength of the faculty of memory is impaired by cherishing the remembrance of injury received from men, while by remembering those done us by devils it remains uninjured?" And when I hesitated, scarcely knowing what answer to make, and begged him to account for it, "Because," said he, "the former is an affection contrary to nature, and the latter is conformable to the nature of the mind." Going on one occasion to the Holy Father Macarius about midday, and being overcome with the heat and thirst, I begged for some water to drink. Content yourself with the shade, was his reply, for many who are now journeying by land, or sailing on the deep, are deprived even of this. Discussing with him afterwards the subject of abstinence, take courage, my son, said he, for 20 years I have neither eaten, drunk, nor slept to satiety, my bread has always been weighed, my water measured, and what little sleep I have had has been stolen by reclining myself against a wall. 12. The death of his father was announced to one of the monks. Cease your blasphemy, said he to the person that told him, my father is immortal. One of the brethren who possessed nothing but a copy of the Gospels, sold it, and distributed the price in food to the hungry, uttering this memorable saying, I have sold the book which says, sell that thou hast and give to the poor. 13. There is an island about the northern part of the city of Alexandria, beyond the lake called Maria, where a monk from Parambole 14 dwells, in high repute among the Gnostics. This person was accustomed to say, that all the deeds of the monks were done for one of these 5 reasons: semicolon, on account of God, nature, custom, necessity, or manual labor. The same also said that there was only one virtue in nature, but that it assumes various characteristics according to the dispositions of the soul, just as the light of the sun is itself without form, but accommodates itself to the figure of that which receives it. Another of the monks said, I withdraw myself from pleasures, in order to cut off the occasions of anger, for I know that it always contends for pleasures, disturbing my tranquillity of mind, and unfitting me for the attainment of knowledge. One of the aged monks said that love knows not how to keep a deposit either of provisions or money. He added, I never remember to have been twice deceived by the devil in the same thing. Thus wrote Evagrius in his book entitled Practice. 15. And in that which he called the Gnostic, he says, we have learned from Gregory the Just, that there are 4 virtues, having distinct characteristics: prudence and fortitude, temperance and justice. That it is the province of prudence to contemplate the sacred and intelligent powers apart from expression, because these are unfolded by wisdom; of fortitude to adhere to truth against all opposition, and never to turn aside to that which is unreal; of temperance to receive seed from the chief husbandman. 16. But to repel him who would sow over it seed of another kind, and finally, of justice to adapt discourse to everyone, according to their condition and capacity, stating some things obscurely, others in a figurative manner, and explaining others clearly for the instruction of the less intelligent. That pillar of truth, Basil of Cappadocia, used to say that the knowledge which men teach is perfected by constant study and exercise, but that which proceeds from the grace of God, by the practice of justice, patience, and mercy. That the former indeed is often developed in persons who are still subject to the passions, whereas the latter is the portion of those only who are superior to their influence, and who during the season of devotion, contemplate that peculiar light of the mind which illumines them. That luminary of the Egyptians, holy Athanasius, assures us that Moses was commanded to place the table on the north 17 side. Let the Gnostics therefore understand what wind is contrary to them, and so nobly endure every temptation, and minister nourishment with a willing mind to those who apply to them. Serapion, the angel of the church of the Thmiaiti, declared that the mind is completely purified by drinking in spiritual knowledge, that charity cures the inflammatory tendencies of the soul, and that the depraved lusts which spring up in it are restrained by abstinence. Exercise thyself continually, said the great and enlightened teacher Didymus, in reflecting on providence and judgment, and endeavor to bear in memory the material of whatever discourses thou mayst have heard on these topics, for almost all fail in this respect. Thou wilt find reasonings concerning judgment in the difference of created forms, and the constitution of the universe, sermons on providence comprehended in those means by which we are led from vice and ignorance to virtue and knowledge. These few extracts from Evagrius we thought it would be appropriate to insert here. There was another excellent man among the monks, named Ammonius, who had so little interest in secular matters, that when he went to Rome with Athanasius, he chose to investigate none of the magnificent works of that city, contenting himself with examining the cathedral of Peter and Paul only. This same Ammonius, on being urged to enter upon the episcopal office, cut off his own right ear, that by mutilation of his person he might disqualify himself for ordination. But when long afterwards Evagrius, whom Theophilus, bishop of Alexandria, wished to make a bishop, having effected his escape without maiming himself in any way, afterwards happened to meet Ammonius, and told him jocosely, that he had done wrong in cutting off his own ear, as he had by that means rendered himself criminal in the sight of God. To which Ammonius replied, "And do you think, Evagrius, that you will not be punished, who from self-love have cut out your own tongue, to avoid the exercise of that gift of utterance which has been committed to you?" There were at the same time in the monasteries very many other admirable and devout characters whom it would be too tedious to enumerate in this place, and besides, if we should attempt to describe the life of each, and the miracles they did by means of that sanctity with which they were endowed, we should necessarily digress too far from the object we have in view. Should anyone desire to become acquainted with their history, in reference both to their deeds and experiences and discourses for the edification of their auditors, as well as how wild beasts became subject to their authority, there is a specific treatise as on the subject, composed by the monk Palladius, who is a disciple of Evagrius, and gives all these particulars in minute detail. In that work he also mentions several women, who practiced the same kind of austerities as the men that have been referred to. Both Evagrius and Palladius flourished a short time after the death of Valens. We must now return to the point whence we diverged. Dash.